Matter of Clarence Haley versus Board of Review, Department of Labor. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jennifer Brooke Condon, the Center for Social Justice, on behalf of Appellant Clarence Haley.
Good morning, Justices. Alan Shore on behalf of Amicus Neyland, New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tess Borden on behalf of Amicus, American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey.
Good morning, Christopher Hamner on behalf of the Board of Review, New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Welcome, counsel. I had Ms. Borden before Mr. Shore for the presentation of arguments. Does that anyone have an objection to that? Then we're ready to go. Ms. Compton, please proceed.
May it please the court.
May I say one more thing first? I'm sorry. If we're not done by 12:30, we may break. I just want to alert all parties, so don't be surprised if we end up adjusting the schedule. Please go ahead. Sorry.
May it please the court. May I please reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time?
Yes.
Thank you. Your Honors, the legislature intended to protect workers like Clarence Haley when it enacted the unemployment compensation law approximately 85 years ago. And that is so because Mr. Haley involuntarily lost his job through no fault or act of his own. He arrested for a crime that he did not commit and detained for more than 7 weeks. Haley lost his job, his apartment, and suffered the insecurity and instability of unemployment, harms that the statute and the legislature intended to mitigate. Although Haley was cleared of all charges after the grand jury issued a no true bill, and the charges against him were dismissed, the Department of Labor Board of Review denied him unemployment benefits on grounds that because his pretrial incarceration was not work-related, it was a personal problem and his separation from employment was voluntary. But there was nothing voluntary about Haley's pretrial incarceration or his job loss. He never quit. He did everything in his power to preserve his employment. He was fired. The appellate division's decision to the contrary, which affirmed the agency's denial of benefits, should be reversed because it is inconsistent with the plain and unambiguous text of the UCL. It undermines its overarching remedial purpose to protect workers like Haley who are out of work through no fault or act of their own. And it is profoundly incompatible with the legal system that purports to assign consequences of criminal wrongdoing only when a person is culpable. This court should likewise overrule the appellate division's 1997 decision in Fennell versus Board of Review, which the lower court followed in this case, because that decision is also premised upon some of the same foundational and fundamental flaws that are challenged here. Starting with the statutory text, NJ 43:21-5 is the relevant provision at issue, is a disqualification statute. It only disqualifies employees from unemployment compensation benefits when they, quote, have left work voluntarily without good cause attributable to work, end quote. This court has held that the phrase or part of that statutory language, left work voluntarily, means what it says, that whether or not somebody has left work voluntarily hinges on whether or not the decision to quit or to stay employed lays with the employee alone. That was this court's decision in Campbell Soup Company versus Board of Review in 1953. And this court has followed that interpretation of the term voluntary. In DiLorenzo, the court found that where an employee who was sick and unable to temporarily perform her jobs intended to keep working and never in fact had quit her job, that the voluntariness term of the statute did not trigger a disqualification. And although the statute does not define the term voluntary, this court's sound and established construction of that term is based both in common sense understandings of the term as set forth in the dictionary and basic common sense. But so here, the agency, instead of following this court's construction of the statute, its plain and unambiguous meaning, instead the agency construed that term to mean work-related. How is that possibly so? Well, it was rooted in a fundamental misunderstanding of the legislative history going back to 1961. In Fennell versus Board of Review, the appellate division stated that when the legislature amended the statute, it added the phrase left voluntarily without good cause attributable to work. And it construed that to mean that the legislature intended to focus on whether or not separations were work-related or not. But what the appellate division was missing was that that was not actually the language that was added in 1961. The only language that was added was the part that related to attributable to work. Going back to the statute's beginning in 1936, the legislature has always distinguished between voluntary departures, for which there is no coverage under the unemployment compensation law, and terminations, decisions that lay with the employer alone about whether or not to end employment. The appellate division misunderstood that in Fennell, and there was no evidence or authority that it cited to support its conclusion that the legislature intended to overhaul the very premise of unemployment compensation law schemes, which is the idea that when a employee leaves volition and decides to quit his or her job, that there is no coverage under the statute.
What is the scope of the rule that you're suggesting? I mean, let's say someone has a sick parent in another state and who needs care, and they simply leave saying they'll be back and they never return and there's a termination. Is that person entitled to the benefits?
Your Honor, yes. If the court applies the statute as written and assesses whether or not they were terminated by the employer because of those conditions, then that is the first step of the statute.
Okay, so let's use the parent example. The employer has an employee who doesn't show up for 6 months, and there's got to be something they do with respect to that employee, I suppose, to clarify the status. As soon as they terminate it, as opposed to just letting that situation go on and on and on, that entitles that employee to the benefits.
Your Honor, that scenario that you've described would likely be covered under a separate provision of the statute I've been addressing, 4321-5, Part B, which allows for employers to discharge someone based on misconduct. Not showing up to work would arguably violate the employer's rules about what's expected of an employee, would be an unexcused absence, and that might be grounds for dismissal as misconduct.
Misconduct to go take care of a sick parent? Maybe the employer doesn't consider it misconduct, sympathetic to the situation.
Well, I was referring to just sort of the unexcused failure to show up for work for months without providing an explanation. It would not be a misconduct if the employer said, I'm taking care of a sick parent. I want to keep my job. Can you keep it open for me? Here is my intent and here's the situation. If the employer decided to discharge the employee in that situation and there was no voluntary departure, there'd be a termination. And I'd like to-
We have to address that. It's a very good question that Justice Patterson asked, but that still was voluntary. Even that's still a voluntary decision to care for an ill parent at a state. And you're dealing with something that was involuntary. You're saying the wrongful arrest and detention. And it seems to me, you'll tell me if I'm mistaken, that that is closest to DiLorenzo, where the petitioner there was felled by an illness involuntarily for a short period of time and was denied benefits here. Isn't that the most direct connection for you?
It is, Your Honor, Justice Albin, because the statute requires, in the first instance, an assessment of whether or not the employee has done anything through an affirmative and volitional act of their own to separate from employment. And DiLorenzo recognized that where there was no purpose to leave the employment and the individual had done nothing wrong, like Mr. Haley, that the statute provides benefits. This court, and as recently as 2008 in Utley versus Board of Review, emphasized that the first question is about whether the employer or the employee makes a decision to leave employment. There, that case involved a worker who actually quit, and the question was the second step of the statute, whether or not he had good cause attributable for leaving. But this court stated that had the employer terminated him, there would be no question he would have coverage under the statute, even though the reason for leaving was a lack of transportation after the employer had changed his the hours that he was required to work. This was a visually impaired worker. And so Justice Patterson raises an important question about what the limits of this rule would be, but what cannot happen. The court will make hard choices about the nature of the circumstances following Utley's approach that there has to be a fact-sensitive, non-mechanistic way of evaluating these questions. But what the agency cannot do is to say that someone who intended to work, did everything reasonable under the circumstances to preserve employment, as a matter of law, should be treated as if they quit. And that is even more offensive when the court considers the overriding purpose of the statute going back to its origins, to protect workers who are blameless and out of work through no fault of their own.
How about the regulations? So if we can address that, it's 12:17-91E. I'll just read the first part of it and we'll get to the part that really pertains to this case. An individual separation from employment shall be reviewed as a voluntarily leaving work issue where the separation was for the following reasons, including but not limited to, and then number 10 is incarceration. So I take it that your interpretation of the incarceration is incarceration for misdeeds, not for someone who's been wrongly arrested, but someone who's been incarcerated for voluntarily violating the law, not for being involuntarily arrested by the police wrongfully.
That's correct, Your Honor, because the agency has no authority to overwrite the statutory terms that require a voluntary departure. And to the extent it reads its regulation to permit that construction, that is an arbitrary, atextual interpretation of the statute that this court is not bound to defer to.
Well, how far then does your argument take you? Does that mean anyone who is subjected to pretrial detention under criminal justice reform will be entitled to unemployment compensation under your interpretation?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, Justice LaBecchia, because the provision we're talking about is a disqualification provision. Another part of the statute requires that an individual actually establish their eligibility for unemployment. That means that a person has to be able to work, available to work, and actively seeking employment. Someone who is currently subject to pretrial incarceration would not be able to establish eligibility, presumably. But at some point in the process, if that person is cleared of all charges and it is determined that they made the reasonable steps that this court said is required in DiLorenzo to preserve their employment, it is possible that other people who were subject to pretrial detention under the Criminal Justice Reform Act, who are deemed to be innocent, like Mr. Haley, would also
be. What does that mean, innocent? Simply because someone's not indicted by a grand jury? I mean, that happens to be what happened here. But can you extrapolate your position even further? Suppose somebody goes to trial and is acquitted.
I think that's
how far does it go?
I think that's the same scenario, Your Honor. If somebody were acquitted, if the charges are dismissed, if there's no a grand jury refuses to indict, in the eyes of the law, this person is innocent, and that is a fundamental premise of our legal system. And here,
when does that get decided? I mean, obviously, this all happened in a relatively short period of time in this case. But if in fact, and I suspect you would say the same goes for someone who ultimately is convicted and then their conviction is overturned on appeal and they are not retried, I assume that person would be in the same category as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
And theoretically PCR could be 10 years later, 20 years later, it happens. So So what happens here? Is it determination await the final outcome of the criminal justice system in order to make a determination as to whether the person is entitled to unemployment benefits?
Well, Your Honor, there are requirements to be eligible for unemployment benefits that may come into play in those scenarios that would make a person ineligible for benefits. And perhaps Mr. Shore, who I know is going to talk about the scheme of the unemployment compensation law more broadly, can address that as well.
Let me just understand what you're saying. Would a person be ineligible because they are currently post-indictment or awaiting trial, or have been convicted, but they have an appeal? These pending situations, which can go on for years, if not longer, is the person eligible for the unemployment or not?
Justice Patterson, what I was suggesting is that because there are time requirements from the discharge that would come into play for the person to apply for unemployment benefits, that they would have to show they were during that period actively seeking work, available for work, that person may not be eligible in any event. But the narrow question that your question goes to is, should somebody be disqualified simply on the basis that their separation from employment as a legal matter was voluntary? And so that scenario you described on the question of the provision at issue here should be treated the same, because they did not engage in any, under the law, they did not engage in any conduct that disqualified them from benefits because the nature of the separation was a baseless criminal charge.
And I assume that all of those categories of individuals would have the same response to what you just said about eligibility for work. I would have been looking for work, except I was incarcerated. So anybody who was incarcerated would have that argument, right? You're not expecting people to be out applying for jobs when they're incarcerated. So where does it stop?
You know, there are outer limits and tough cases that could come before the court. I would imagine the court could interpret the term available in recognition that somebody was fighting a criminal charge and subject to a longstanding battle with respect to the criminal charges, that maybe they were not available. To me, that is a far better conclusion than to say that somebody who was innocent and subject to involuntary pretrial detention and in short order cleared of all charges against him should be deemed to have voluntarily given up his job. And I would say as well, Justice Patterson, these are questions that come up, but the majority of jurisdictions that have addressed this issue have not confronted a can of worms in finding that pretrial incarceration followed by dismissal of all charges somehow is a judicially unmanageable standard.
Can I come back to your original,
this is gonna be quick. Shouldn't we just be focusing on pretrial incarceration and not be dealing with other issues that aren't before us right now? Like someone who's been in prison for 20 years and winds up getting cleared on a PCR.
Absolutely, and the court has followed that approach. In the context of transportation issues, the court has said there is no per se bar to ineligibility. The court in Utley said you have to look at a fact-sensitive analysis. The same is true here. I just want to respond to Justice Patterson's comment and say, yes, being innocent in the eyes of the law should matter, but there may be other ways in which those cases can be addressed by the court.
Okay, so that's a perfect segue to come back to your starting position, which is segmenting the analysis to look first at the voluntariness question and then separately the second part. And my question to you is, haven't you changed the test? Now you say our case law got off on the wrong foot, but we have had case law in effect for a long time that have tied those two concepts inextricably to make the unemployment scheme look at whether or not the person voluntarily left for a good reason that relates to the work itself, not to anything else that's going on in their life. And by segmenting the analysis, as you're suggesting, you have changed the way in which eligibility will be considered. Do you agree?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't.
Why?
the way the court, you said, did we get off on the wrong foot? The way the court, when first addressing the UCL, has always focused on voluntariness, going back to the 1930s. And when the subsequent language was added in 1961, it was clear that the legislature only meant to address situations where somebody quit, and then the question whether they were entitled to a safe harbor because they did for good work-related reasons. To the extent your question, Justice LaVecchia, goes to self, which used some language to suggest that the court might be willing to recognize this concept of constructive quits, where a certain categories of reasons for departure should be treated as if the person quit, even though they factually terminated. I would suggest that the court was not clear in adopting such a doctrine. And in fact, in that specific case itself, the court treated the factual record as if the two employees at issue had, as a matter of record, actually quit. Justice O'Hearn argued valiantly in dissent that they should be treated as if they were terminated, but this court didn't dismiss that as an erroneous interpretation of the statute. The court emphasized that as a factual matter, they actually had quit. And this court, again, when discussing self in Utley, emphasized that the employees had quit. So I would just suggest, Justice LaVecchia, the court has not gone very far with the convergence of these two terms. It may have muddled the question slightly in self, but this court can clarify that. And in fact, it has to some extent, because in Utley, the court said, we look at these questions as a matter of fact-centered analysis. There is no—
Utley is certainly the case where the court has gone the furthest in that direction than it ever had. But that doesn't mean that it's changed the fundamental nature of the test as to whether or not the reason for quitting is utterly divorced from good cause related to the job.
Well, Justice LaVecchia, this court has time and again described the purpose of that legislative amendment as being simply to distinguish between two kinds of voluntary departures, those with good cause and those without. And
And it was good cause. This is what I keep bringing you back to, this, Condon. It's good cause that has to be related to the work itself, not to something else. And in Utley, we were able to make that link. I don't see how you make that link in the setting that we have here.
But Justice LaVecchia, in Utley, the court was only addressing that second issue because there was no question that Utley had quit. He quit to avoid being fired. And this court stated in Utley that had he been terminated based upon the very same transportation issues, there was no question he would have had coverage. Yeah,
but Utley, I know a little bit about Utley since I wrote Utley. Utley was work related because we were dealing with a sight impaired employee who was taking public transportation, and then the employer wound up changing his work schedule so he couldn't take public transportation any longer. I mean, so the employer was directly responsible for the reason why Utley could no longer get to work. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why he quit. So that's why I said earlier, I thought DiLorenzo is your best argument, because DiLorenzo's illness was not work-related. She just got ill and could not go to work in the same way that this person was arrested wrongfully and couldn't go to work. That seems to be, to me at least, the best comparison for you. Am I mistaken?
Yes, Your Honor, but the part of the analysis has to be whether or not the decision to go or stay lays with the employee or the employer. When the legislature amended the statute, it did not signal to this court that it intended to rewrite the term voluntary and have it be an amorphous consideration of whether or not it's work-related or not. Justice Albin, you're exactly right that the reason why Utley was entitled to coverage, even though he quit, was because he triggered that safe harbor. But that doesn't mean, and DiLorenzo shows this, that doesn't mean that employees that never quit are entitled.
In Utley, we said it was a constructive quit because we basically said he would have been terminated either way. He had no way of getting to work. He was sight impaired and didn't have public transportation available. And all that was as a result of the employer's switching of his schedule.
That's right. And that is why he was entitled to the safe harbor. But if he were terminated outright for transportation related reasons, he would have also been entitled to protection. And so the point is that the statute requires consideration in the first instance of whether somebody was discharged or not. And this court said there would be no question he'd be covered if he was. And then secondly, whether the underlying cause is one that entitles the person to the safe harbor. I want to return for a moment to the regulations because I think it also is instructive to this court in interpreting what to make of the agency's discussion of incarceration in this regard. As we note in our reply brief before the appellate division, when the regulations were proposed in 1998 during the notice and comment period, the department clarified that it did not intend that this rule would automatically result in a finding of voluntarily leaving work without good cause attributable to work when the leaving was due to the reasons listed. And then even farther, the court said that the agency said that the relevant circumstances of an individual's incarceration, focusing on that particular part of the regulation, will be considered in deciding the voluntary or involuntary nature of the separation and if a disqualification is applicable. So even the agency, when it adopted the regulations, understood the threshold question is voluntariness. But what happened is once the regulations were implemented, the agency did exactly what it said it wouldn't do. It said that it was effectively adopting a per se rule of ineligibility based upon incarceration, whether the person was found to be innocent of all charges and released, or whether they're convicted.
And we rejected that in Utley because one of the things on the list is lack of transportation. And we said, wait, we have to do a very individualized an intensive analysis of that, because in the Utley case, yeah, it was lack of transportation caused by the employer.
That's right. And I think the agency might suggest, though, that Utley suggests that there's only a fact-sensitive analysis about whether or not the safe harbor is triggered, that there's a quit, but with good cause attributable to work. I think the regulatory history points out that the agency itself contemplated and promised that it would also engage in a holistic, non-mechanistic analysis in the first instance of whether or not something was voluntary, but they haven't. Council has looked at all of the unpublished decisions involving incarceration issued by the agency. They all say the same thing, that a person who loses their job on account of incarceration, as a matter of law, is deemed to have voluntarily left, to have quit. That is not a holistic review. That is not a mechanistic, that is a mechanistic approach to the statute. It's inconsistent with Utley, and it violates not only the text, the unambiguous text and the meaning of voluntary under the statute, it's inconsistent with the overarching remedial purpose.
You quoted from the 1998 comment, and the first sentence there says, the rule states that the individual separation may be reviewed as a voluntary leaving work issue. And then the regulation changed that to shall be reviewed. How did we go from the permissive to the mandatory? Do you know?
I know that there were multiple comments that the agency took into account, concerned that this was atextual, was not following the statutory scheme, and perhaps the agency was trying to soften the blow. But Chief Justice, I would point out that though the language changed to shall, it's still incredibly ambiguous what the agency meant. It says, shall be reviewed as a voluntary leaving work issue. Doesn't say shall be deemed. That was also in an earlier version of the statute. Even the regulations recognize that courts still have to implement their duty to interpret the statute, and the regulations are just one source. What's the best reading of the regulation? That the agency is providing some examples, which when there is a voluntary quit, these are some examples that may not, in the agency's view, be related to the employment, and therefore the person will not be entitled to the safe harbor, even though they have voluntarily left their employment. The regulations are not clear, the regulatory history is inconsistent, and the agency has not complied with it set with the statements in the public record during the notice and comment period that said that there was no per se bar to eligibility. It has treated it as such, and that's even further reason for this court not to defer to the agency's interpretation of the regulation here, and to clarify, as it did in Utley, that these are simply considerations that can be factored into the analysis under the statute of whether or not somebody has left voluntarily and with good cause attributable to work. Want to talk about the other jurisdictions. I was suggesting that
May I just inject that we're at the half hour mark, I think. So I'm going to encourage you to briefly cover what other jurisdictions have, because we're looking at our statute here.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I would just say that other jurisdictions have managed to apply nearly identical statutes as New Jersey, Iowa, Florida, Missouri, and have not had any sort of difficulty in construing an involuntary departure as one in which a person is subject to pretrial incarceration and then all charges are dismissed. I think the appellate division here misunderstood that some of those statutory provisions are identical to New Jersey's. And really, I think as Mr. Shore will point out, New Jersey stands alone and is an outlier, as the Iowa Supreme Court recognized. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And I'm going to invite Ms. Borden and Mr. Shore to incorporate arguments to the extent that's appropriate. Ms. Borden, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'd like to touch on two points briefly following Ms. Condon's argument. And the first point I'd like to make is drawing from Justice Patterson's first question about the scope of the rule we're seeking here. And in fact, we're not seeking a new rule at all. Amicus, the ACLU of New Jersey, is only seeking that this court, by this opinion, reaffirm DiLorenzo, reaffirm the basic principle that a person who finds themselves unemployed through no fault of their own, including though through no fault or cause of the employer, should still be entitled to benefits, should not be disqualified when they do not voluntarily leave. And I'd like to make a point on DiLorenzo. I think it has been misunderstood over the decades to be a judge-made exception limited to health-related causes. It may be the case that the board's, that the agency's decision following remand by this court suggested that it was an exception limited to health, but this court post-remand in affirming the agency's interpretation said explicitly that, quote, we think this view of the statute is correct. So the DiLorenzo opinion is explicitly a statutory interpretation opinion. It is not a judge-made exception limited to health, and we would ask that Your Honors reaffirm that principle and reaffirm that it is the statutory interpretation and not a health exception.
Ms. Ford, let me ask you something about your first point, and that is how practicable is a rule that says that where a court is told one result should happen if the occurrence happened because through no fault of the person's own, versus whatever else, what other circumstances may exist. What does that mean, no fault of your own? So does that mean things happened and the person was entirely under the control of other people and other forces? Does it mean that that they made a decision which seemed innocuous, but it turned out to cause them to be absent from work?
I think that's an important clarification, Justice Patterson. And to go to your initial hypothetical, putting aside misconduct for not showing up to work, putting aside potential family leave or healthcare leave, I think if a person moves, whether to take care of family or otherwise, and ends up not being able to do their job, it's most likely a voluntary quit and there would be disqualification. Similarly, you know, as in White, for example, if a person no longer can get to work because they live so far away and they have to live so far away because of their parole conditions, it's sort of within their control. So I think I appreciate that.
Let me stop you there, because I think you could make a principled argument on behalf of that person that their parole conditions were not their choice. They would prefer to live close to work. And that was imposed on them unfairly, perhaps by someone else. So You see what I'm talking about? To say no fault of your own, life is complicated. There are numerous factors that enter into many decisions that all of us make on a daily basis. But no, I'm just wondering about no fault of your own being a judicial principle to apply.
So I think no fault means within one's control and also recognizing the conditions of employment. So it might be that someone on parole in New Jersey really wants to take a job in Pennsylvania, but can't move the location of their parole and therefore is unable to take a job in Pennsylvania. That's of course too bad, but it is still sort of within their personal circumstances.
A big factor in that and a but-for causation here would say that the parole conditions were imposed maybe consistently with the law, maybe not, but they were imposed on that person. That's not something that they chose.
And so I think that the critical piece here is that Mr. Haley's pretrial incarceration, and indeed Amicus would argue any pretrial incarceration, is not fault-based and it is not within control. And significantly, and here the appeal tribunal made a distinction and said this was not a case of false imprisonment. It is in fact like false imprisonment. Being arrested here, ultimately with a no true bill, is entirely outside of the person's control. It's outside of their fault. It's outside of their responsibility. The appeal tribunal, without explanation, said this is clearly not a case of false imprisonment or misidentification. I'm conscious I may be stealing my colleague, Mr. Schor's metaphor here, but you know, by analogy, if someone were kidnapped, it would not be their fault. I think it would strain credulity to imagine that if Mr. Haley were falsely imprisoned, or as the appeal tribunal said he was not, or as Mr. Schor argues, you know, if he were kidnapped and taken out of the state, that he would have voluntarily left. And so what we're really looking at is, was it within his control? Justice Alvin, I think you're muted.
Through no fault of his own is actually part of the legislation. So that isn't language that you're creating. I mean, that's actually part of the original legislation that I think goes back to the 1930s. In the parole example, the person still has committed a crime, okay, voluntarily, that has placed himself or herself under the authority of the state. And that's different from your kidnapping example that you've just given, or someone who's been wrongfully arrested by the state. Is that a distinction that you would accept?
Yes, Justice Alvin, it is for these purposes. And I think what it comes down to here is, again, we're just talking about the disqualification section, 43215. There's a whole separate benefits eligibility section, of course, under 21.4. But as a matter of disqualification, what we know is the statute disqualifies people who quit, who voluntarily leave without good cause attributable to work. And this court, in its jurisprudence, has taken those quits to be explicit and fault-based, as in, for example, the case of Yardville, where, you know, the person, as a condition of employment, had to maintain a driver's license, committed some false-based act, driving while drunk, and lost his license. And it's also found that in constructive quits, where the person, you know, leaves and effectively quits, even though she doesn't ever tender her resignation. The important thing here is that pretrial incarceration can neither be considered an explicit quit, nor can it be a constructive quit, when the person had no control over their body, over their arrest, over their incarceration. If I may, because I think Your Honors covered this with Ms. Condon, I'd like to move on to my second point then, which is the regulations and the interpretation Amicus ACLU of New Jersey seeks there. And here, as Ms. Condon laid out, the regulations cannot control per Utley. They cannot be applied mechanistically here. I would like to suggest that the regulations be interpreted by Your Honors to exclude pretrial incarceration. Under our constitutional framework, under the CJRA, pretrial incarceration cannot be punitive. It cannot be considered fault-based. And significantly here, I want to address what I think Your Honors might consider potentially opening the floodgates under the CJRA or PCR or whatever it may be. We're not here seeking the receipt of benefits for anyone while they're incarcerated.
Why do we have to go? We have a case before us of a person who was detained pretrial and found to have been wrongfully detained. Why do we have to go any further? You now want to deal with an entire class beyond the case before us? Why do we have to do that?
Justice Avenue, of course, do not. I just wanted to clarify that the fact that Mr. Haley was found not guilty, that the grand jury did not indict, means that temporally we are able to look at his applications for unemployment benefits. In most pretrial incarceration cases, I think you will see that that ends up being converted to an incarceratory sentence, whether that be, you know, by time served and then the pretrial incarceration time becomes a sentence, or by an extended term post-conviction of incarceration.
Is it the equivalent though, counsel? I mean, this individual was detained after a probable cause finding by a judge.
Yes.
So is that the equivalent of a false arrest?
No, legally it's not.
So how can we say he's been illegally detained simply because down the road, the grand jury chose not to indict?
I apologize if that's what I suggested. I think false imprisonment or illegal detention is a step further. I meant to use it only for purposes of demonstration. Okay. The point here is that we're looking at whether or not Mr. Haley voluntarily left his employment. I think as a matter of the factual record, and Ms. Condon could speak to this better on rebuttal perhaps, but I think he was in fact fired. He was terminated. He failed to show up to work for a 5-day work week, I assume, for 7 days. He was arrested on December 14th. And by December 21st, he had been replaced. I think if he had been playing hooky, he might have been fired also. And I'm not sure that we would get into the reason that he was playing hooky. It just so happened that he was trying to maintain his job, had his mom calling Garden State Laboratories and was not able to show up because he was incarcerated. And then in fact, he was terminated. He was replaced with another maintenance worker. So I think we are not even within 21-5 disqualification land at all. I think Mr. Haley, as a matter of fact, was terminated. But even if your honors are to consider this as a constructive quit question, we would argue that he has not constructively quit because he has not voluntarily left. And he has not voluntarily left under a pure reading of the statute, and he has not voluntarily left even under the regulations, because the regulations, as Utley instructs, must be applied in individual circumstances. And in this case, Justice Alvin, of pretrial incarceration, where he gets out in time to be still eligible for benefits otherwise and apply for those benefits.
And in this case, you can say through no fault of his own, because you have a legal determination that says that there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge him.
And that's where, Your Honor, I was encouraging you to go a bit further, which is to say, under the law, pretrial incarceration must always be no fault. Our Constitution requires that. The CJRA requires that. As a practical matter, I don't think you're ever going to have the counterfactual, because someone who was incarcerated pretrial, who is then found guilty, will then have that pretrial incarceration either converted to an incarceratory term of a sentence through a time served plea, or will do more time. And so I don't think this issue would ever come before you. But as a legal matter, I'm encouraging your honors to reaffirm that pretrial incarceration under the law cannot be fault-based.
So what does the standard that you're proposing actually accomplish? Individuals who are convicted and sentenced ultimately would not receive the benefit. Is it just an analytical construct that you're hoping to persuade the court to follow, or is there a practical consequence as well?
I think, Your Honor, the practical consequence would be left to be seen by future cases. It is certainly an analytical one. I think there may be cases where, you know, someone is detained pretrial under the CJRA at first, and then potentially, you know, during a pandemic or otherwise, ordered released and still has not been convicted under the law. I think if the person were otherwise eligible under 21-4, which of course is a separate consideration altogether, then this court would have to look at if they lost their job because of that pretrial incarceration, was that disqualifying?
So then that individual theoretically could seek unemployment benefits, then go to trial, be convicted nonetheless, and still get the benefit.
And potentially have to repay. We've seen that before, where, you know, the funds must be repaid.
But they're not repaid. So this is where your analytical construct happens to clash with reality. If we followed your construct, every single person who is arrested and therefore is out of a job is going to be applying for unemployment benefits. And they'll never be able to, and we know in these cases, after they get the benefits and they're incarcerated, there's not going to be any repayment. So,
and I in fact conceded too much when I said, excuse me, repay, because I think if the reason for leaving work is pretrial incarceration only under the law to preserve the presumption of innocence, that must be no fault. That must not be a voluntary leaving. I think just
so you're saying that a person who is found guilty can still get the, eventually found guilty or pleads guilty, can still get the benefits for pretrial incarceration?
I think.
Is that a yes?
I think that no. Well, I think it's a parade of horribles that will never happen because of the way 21-4 benefits eligibility works. So my understanding, and I recognize I'm not an employment lawyer, but my understanding of the UCL scheme is that someone must prove affirmatively their eligibility. Even if they are otherwise eligible, they may still be disqualified. So they have to first make a threshold finding or
showing. Okay, so someone is in pretrial incarceration. They say the only reason I'm not out here looking for a job is because I'm incarcerated. I'll eventually be found to be wrongfully incarcerated, but that's why. So I'm eligible. And then eventually that person either pleads guilty or is convicted. What's their status?
So as a preliminary matter, they are never eligible to receive benefits for the time they're incarcerated because they are not available to work. And we are not arguing here some constructive voluntariness to their availability. I think the statute is clear. This is not that case. They are not eligible for benefits while they're incarcerated. The only question is, and Mr. Haley is not claiming benefits for the 55 days that he was incarcerated. The only question is whether Mr. Haley in this case or this future person in our hypothetical can claim unemployment benefits when they get out.
And so let's say it's 3 months, time served, okay? They eventually released, become eligible, plead guilty, time served, nothing further. Are they eligible under your construct?
So under my construct, I think the time served plea would convert that converts the pretrial incarceration into an incarceratory sentence. It becomes a sentence term. So it is fault-based in that case. So they are not eligible. I think if someone were to do additional time, my understanding of eligibility is they would not be able to establish the base pay period. And so they would not be able to collect upon their release from prison either. So I think to answer the chief's earlier question, and I'm conscious of the time, I think this is largely analytical. It is important, and amicus often stands before you on constitutional analytical grounds. It is important for the law that pretrial incarceration not be associated with fault. That our constitution requires that, the CJRA requires that, your honor's jurisprudence requires that.
You, Mr. Shore, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good afternoon, justices. NELA New Jersey is the organization that actually represents claimants throughout New Jersey. And we come here as a friend of the court with the experience of thousands of representations of unemployed workers. We do not advocate to the court that there is anything wrong with the current statutory or regulatory scheme. We believe that in this case, the appellate division and the Board of Review misapplied the law to the facts in this case, and therefore it's arbitrary and capricious and should be reversed. The touchstone of our statutory scheme is that a worker who is unemployed and otherwise eligible receives unemployment unless that employee has voluntarily done something that disqualifies the employee, whether it be a voluntary misconduct or it be a voluntary quit without good cause attributable to the work. The touchstone is that the employee's voluntary act is the catalyst for the separation of employment. And that's the difference that we have here. Mr. Haley's voluntary act in no way was the catalyst for the separation of employment. The separation of employment occurred because he was incarcerated for a crime that he ultimately was not charged with, and he claims he did not commit. He didn't file for unemployment while he was in jail. He got out of jail, had no job, and then applied for benefits. At that point, he was available for work. He was actively seeking work. He was qualified for benefits. And so the only question was whether or not his separation was caused by his own voluntary act. And here there was no voluntary act. He was having breakfast with his family and he was taken away and put in jail. His mother called every day to try to keep his job. The cases that we've had with the court have not been exceptions to the rule, and I've heard it discussed today, exceptions. In Yardville Supply, for example, this court held that where an employee had lost his driver's license because he was driving drunk, he should be disqualified even though he didn't voluntarily quit. Again, the focus was on the fact that a voluntary act, his decision to drive drunk, was the catalyst that caused him to lose his license and caused him to then become unemployed. In Self, the court found that the employee chose not to fix his car when his car broke down, and that therefore those car problems created a voluntary quit because the employee's own actions had been the catalyst for the separation of employment. Justice Patterson had raised an issue if an employee moves to take care of a sick relative. That is always, in our experience, deemed to be a voluntary quit because even though it's good cause and even though there's a good reason for it, the employee's decision to move is the catalyst for the separation of employment. It's not something that the employer has done. And for those reasons, Mr. Haley should not have been disqualified for benefits. We had this problem. I was before this court a year ago in McLean and Blake versus Board of Review. And there was confusion that was caused by the misconception that there has to be a binary choice between, well, the employer did something wrong or the employee did something wrong. Sometimes no one's at fault. In the case of domestic violence, for example, in the DiLorenzo case, where someone is out because they become ill or hospitalized and they've done everything they can to keep their employment. And sometimes neither the employer nor the employee should be charged. And our statutory scheme provides for that. There's a trust fund that the money comes out of if the money isn't properly charged to the employer and the employee is not disqualified. These cases come up rarely. In McLean, it was two employees who had left to take a better job, but those jobs were then rescinded before they started. And it was unfair to charge the prior employer, unfair to disqualify the employee, but we have a trust fund for that. And for those rare cases, it comes out of the trust fund, and that trust fund is funded by employer contributions and employee contributions. And if it goes low, then they raise the rate. And if there's a surplus, they lower the rate. So our entire statutory scheme is holding in place. And we advocate it does not need to be changed. What only needs to happen is for this holding for Mr. Haley should be reversed because it was arbitrary and capricious and simply wrongly decided. We do also ask the court to review the Fennell case and to hold that that is not good law. It really is the only appellate case that our exhaustive research found in the entire country where any court has held that an employee's wrongful arrest and incarceration constitutes a disqualification from unemployment benefits. And so we ask that Fennell be reversed. I think I've addressed the questions from the court, and hopefully I've clarified our position and the law. I'm open for any questions, and if not, then I rest.
Any questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Shore.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamner.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. As the court has alluded to earlier, since the statute determining disqualification was changed, adding whether something, a leaving work, is attributable to the work, that has been the focus. The focus is whether leaving was attributable to the work. The court followed this itself, where this court said, a departure not attributable to the work is a voluntary departure without good cause related to the work. The appellate division followed this reasoning in Fennell, where it followed the self case and looked at whether in any way the employer had contributed to this. Now, there are exceptions to this, but those exceptions are within the province of the legislature, not the court. The legislature has provided a few, very few, exceptions since the change in statute, one of which is someone alluded to domestic violence. Another is whether someone is relocating due to following a military spouse. These are exceptions created by the legislature. Now, petitioners would have the court bifurcate the argument, say, number one, is it voluntary? Number two, is it attributable to work? But this court has found that if it's not attributable to work and properly kept the focus on whether it's attributable to the work, the proper focus is that it would be voluntary if not attributable to the work. Now, looking at Mr. Haley's case.
Counsel, how does what you're saying fit into the DiLorenzo case? You're going through exceptions.
The DiLorenzo case was created by the Board of Review very early on. The Board of Review decided that personal illness would not disqualify this individual. That's not a legislative enactment. That's not in the statute. And this court has held that is, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're not walking away from DiLorenzo, are you?
I'm not walking away from DiLorenzo because this court recognized the agency's decision in that case.
Okay, so tell us how DiLorenzo is different from this case, other than the fact that Mrs. DiLorenzo was ill and that happened involuntarily to her. And in this case, as we know from the ultimate grand jury decision, this person was wrongly charged. Mm-hmm. How are they different?
Right. This person was not convicted. There was no indictment. The person was not brought to trial. The Board of Review made a decision in the DiLorenzo case. It made its own exception for that person. This court has recognized that the agency can do that. The agency can interpret the statutes in the way it sees fit, considering the details of the case. In this particular case, as in Fennell and Self, the Board of Review did not see any contribution to the by the employer as to the person.
My question to you was, how is DiLorenzo different from this case? And you may say they're not different. They are different. DiLorenzo was an arbitrary decision of the board. We shouldn't follow it. But tell me how they're different. Because in DiLorenzo, the employee was ill.
Yes. Right?
No fault of her own. We have someone arrested, later charges dismissed through no fault of his own. How are they different? I'm trying to figure that out.
There's not, I will concede that there's not much difference between them. There's not much difference between them, but that was the decision early on by the Board of Review. It was on remand from the court and they changed their decision. I cannot point to any particular aspects of that would greatly distinguish it from this case, other than the circumstances, other than the fact that the person was ill.
There's one thing that I will tell you. One thing that concerns me about the position being taken by Mr. Haley in this case is the practicality of making a determination when the guilt or innocence of the individual is in most cases not decided early on. Now in the Di Lorenzo case, the medical situation was known immediately, and a determination of whether or not Ms. Di Lorenzo was entitled to benefits could be made on a prompt basis. Am I correct that there is a practical problem for the board when in most situations, guilt or innocence in the criminal justice system is not something that's known in the first 60 days after an arrest?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, it absolutely is a practical problem. And as the court pointed out, there could be significant delay from arrest to decision, you know, guilt or not guilt. This is one of an infinite number of possible situations in which an individual can not appear at work. It's not attributable to.
Is illness going to be, do you make a distinction between a 2-week illness and a 3-month illness? So if a person is out with a very serious illness for 3 months and tries to keep her job unavailable to do so, would you say she's unavailable for benefits?
Unavailable during the period of time that the person is ill. If the person's available and able to return to work, they may be eligible for benefits.
Okay.
But in that scenario, it's known that the person's ill. I mean, it's just known that the person right off the bat is ill. So right. What I'm getting at is a little different temporal problem, not the difference between a long and a short illness, but the different, but an unknown, which is this person incarcerated pretrial, and is it going to lead to a conviction, or is it going to lead to an acquittal, or are charges going to be dropped, or a reversal? All the different scenarios that can happen in the criminal justice system, where a decision on this ultimately could await many, many proceedings. So maybe I'm not justifiably concerned about that. Are there any other situations where the board confronts a contingency that can remain open for years other than this incarceration issue?
I'm sure there can be an infinite number of personal situations that are purely personal, not attributable to work, similar to what Your Honor is talking about. There can be any number of personal, and there's no doubt that this is an unfortunate circumstance for Mr. Haley. I mean, it's you know, a major life problem, but there are an infinite number of other similar situations where whether someone will ever be able to return to work is present. Whether it's,
Mr. Hamner, is it your position that all cases involving incarceration should be treated the same for purposes of eligibility?
Yes, and I'm saying that because the exceptions are created by the legislature, and the legislature has specifically not created an exception for this when it has for other situations.
Well, why don't we look at it through the lens of the regulation instead? To the extent a regulation imposes a per se bar that would extend to cases where the state had insufficient proof to even obtain an indictment, how is that regulation reasonable?
Well, the regulation is reasonable because the focus is upon how it affects the employer. And the employer's account will be charged if this person collects unemployment benefits.
And so Mr. Shore was just telling us that there are situations where neither side is truly at fault, mm-hmm. and the fund covers that. Why wouldn't this fit in that construct?
The lines have to be drawn. There have to be lines drawn. The lines are drawn by the legislature. The fund is not unlimited. There are any number of situations that can be equated with this, where a person is unable to report to work for something that's not attributable to the work. The fund is not unlimited, so the lines have to be drawn, and the legislature has not decided to make an exception. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, please finish your sentence.
No,
Is there anything this individual could have done in order to prevent him not being able to show up for work?
No.
So what is it in the legislative history that suggests the legislature meant in a situation such as this, where someone is physically prevented from showing up for work, to not be able to receive benefits?
Because the change in legislation in 1961 brought the focus to whether it's attributable to the work. The focus is not on the individual. The focus is not on the individual situation. The focus is on whether it's attributable to the work. And this court agreed with that in Self. The appellate division followed that in Fennell. And in fact, certification was denied in Fennell.
But the board it didn't follow it in DiLorenzo. And we didn't follow it in DiLorenzo, correct?
This court agreed with the board review in DiLorenzo, correct?
So look at the regulations that the Chief Justice was referring to. One of them is lack of, it would suggest that an individual separation from employment shall be reviewed as voluntarily leaving work. And number one is lack of transportation, right?
Yes.
Yet in Utley, we said that particular regulation should not be viewed mechanistically, because in Utley, we have an impaired visioned petitioner who was unable to access public transportation because of the shift change by his employer. So we read that regulation in context, and also said that it was not an automatic bar. And if we did that with respect to the lack of transportation, like, why wouldn't we take a similar approach to number 10, incarceration, and say incarceration where the defendant's wrongful conduct resulted in its incarceration is one thing, but for a person pretrial detained on charges that are dismissed, that's different. But like, why wouldn't we take the same approach?
Because in Utley is distinguishable because the employer had taken some action that contributed to the employee's inability to get to work. That's not the case here. That's not the case. Haley's employer had nothing to do with this.
Going back to the legislative history and the 1961 amendment, is it fair to say, broadly speaking, the legislature was attempting to separate out voluntary quits, voluntary departures for purely personal reasons from terminations?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what you mean. We're not looking at a termination. I think the focus for the legislature was whether purely personal situations can be attributed to the employer at all. And when the employer has not contributed to the situation, then the employer shall not be charged and the person shall not be eligible for benefits. Now, I note that in the legislatively created exceptions, the legislation specifically says that the employer's accounts shall not be charged. That's the domestic abuse victim exception and also the military spouse exception.
Can I ask you a question about the statute and the regulation? In both instances, it talks about what you said is a per se bar. It says the following events, if they happen, are not a voluntary termination or voluntarily leaving work. And one of them is incarceration. But the statute also says that the following separation, in the case of the statute may be reviewed, in the case of regulation shall be reviewed as a voluntary leaving work. Why would it say that? What's the review? If it's a per se bar, there's nothing to review. They're either in jail or not in jail. They're either have transportation or don't have transportation.
Well, I think that the may be reviewed or should be reviewed in the regulation refers to the fact that it looked at the facts of each case. And one of the factors or the main factor to be looked at is whether the employer contributed to it. So for the case of incarceration, if somehow an employer somehow was found to have contributed to the incarceration. I can't think of an example. Perhaps some white collar crime that the person was required to do as a result of their job or something like that. I believe that's what they're referring to. They're referring to looking at the facts of each case. And when they looked at the facts of this case, they did not find any contribution by the employer to the employee's situation.
But you said, one of the reasons we have that is to determine, and this is kind of the fairness argument, whether the employer's account should be charged. And there are instances where the employer didn't cause it and the employee didn't cause it. And there are provisions, a trust fund created so that the employer's account isn't charged. Why isn't this nothing in the statute? Statute says may be reviewed. Regulation says shall be reviewed. Nothing about whether it has anything to do with the employer or attributable work, just may or shall be reviewed as to whether as a voluntary leaving work. Not a voluntary leaving work attributable to the employer, just a voluntary leaving work. There's already a way to deal with it, so it's not unfair to the employer. That is, the trust fund kicks in. Isn't that kind of a waste of verbiage, or at least that or they left something out? Should be reviewed as to whether the employer's at fault.
Should be reviewed as to whether the employer contributed to it.
That doesn't
fund is not unlimited. Mr.
Shore. I'm not disagreeing. And by the way, as Mr. Shore said, they do from time to time increase the contributions of employers' employees to the trust fund if it gets close to being insolvent. But they didn't say reviewed as a voluntary leaving work attributable to the employer. They just said a voluntary leaving work. And certainly that's consistent, that notion that they're entitled to some hearing and resolution of voluntariness, as Justice Albin's pointed out, that's consistent with DiLorenzo. That kind of explains how DiLorenzo is consistent with the statute and regulations, and frankly, might be consistent with a similar determination here. Just a question.
Well, the statute makes specific reference to whether it's attributable to work. And in the comment to the regulation does that as well. That's inseparable. The Board of Review takes that as inseparable, as this court's lead itself did, where it's considered a voluntary quit if it's not attributable to the work. It's not inconsistent with the statute.
So you've told us two things. Number one, that the only consideration in the review is whether it's attributable to work. And number two, that all cases of incarceration should be treated the same and you're not eligible for benefits. Is that consistent with the comment from 1998, where in the last section, the last sentence, the agency is saying, listen, if it's only 2 days of incarceration, that's one thing. But if it's a longer period, that's another. That doesn't sound like the per se approach where the only consideration is whether it's attributable to the worker, to me. Have I misunderstood it?
Well, it 2 days, I think the board would be looking at that to determine whether that is truly someone who's not able to go to work. 2 days is de minimis.
So are you now suggesting that not all incarcerations are to be treated the same?
Well, not all incarcerations if it's attributable to the work. This is part of the review. The review would be as to the circumstances leading to it, whether the employer in any way was unreasonable or if the employer contributed to it. Incarceration for 2 days, for example, if someone is incarcerated on a Friday morning and say, I can't be there until Monday, and the weekend they have the weekend off anyway. I don't think the board would consider that a quit. 1 day's absence or 2 days absence. If there are no further questions, that's
I'd like you to comment on one other matter. It's the very end of the appellate division decision where it says, by separating voluntary from whether it was attributable to the employment, Haley's interpretation allows for an expansion of benefits to any non-work-related reason an employee is terminated from employment. Can you comment on that and give us?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat where that is? I haven't.
The first sentence of the last paragraph of the opinion. I was wondering if you could provide some context, some examples for the fear that the appellate division here expresses.
Well, there can be any number of situations in which a personal circumstance prevents someone from going to work. And previously there was talk of fault, no fault. That's not the consideration here. The appellate division is concerned that any non-work related reason, it's unlimited, infinite number of situations where that could be the situation.
Give us a couple.
It has to be.
Give us a couple of, this is what the Chief Justice wanted to know. Give us a couple of involuntary ones that you think would offend the statute.
This is a tragedy for Mr. Haley. So any other kind of personal tragedy as well. Talk about, for example, if someone's house burns down and they can't get back on their feet or they can't get to work. It's not related to the employer. There can be any number of situations. You're asking me for.
No. So that's
already covered by your reg, lack of housing.
Okay. All right.
One could argue that that's voluntary too. It's because, you know, your house burns down doesn't mean you can't get to work.
Right.
It's the difference between being ill, not being able to get out of bed, and or being incarcerated, not being able to get to work. So go ahead. Give us some examples if you can think of any.
Some examples. It's difficult to think of examples that are not related to transportation or housing.
So just look, we're not trying to put you on the spot, but the fact that it's really difficult to come up with examples, doesn't that suggest this isn't going to be blowing the door off?
I don't agree, Your Honor. Just because I can't think of examples now, I'm sure that, you know, there can be any number of life circumstances that can prevent someone from reporting to work. And like I mentioned,
how about incarceration at a later
and can't
state?
Return.
I'm sorry.
How about somebody who's out of the country on vacation and a pandemic occurs and they cannot return to work?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Unrelated, not attributable to cause of the employer,
right,
but is preventing them from getting back and returning to work.
That's a perfect example.
Right.
It's not attributable to the employer. The employer's account should not be charged.
You would deny that person unemployment benefits?
Based upon the statute and the precedent,
you're not sick.
The Board of Review would be pandemic. We have to deny that.
So think of the test that we heard a little bit earlier in the argument to focus on whether a voluntary act was the catalyst. That person went on vacation. What did Mr. Haley do?
He did. Because it was no bill, there hasn't been any finding that he did anything.
Precisely.
Right.
And your position is that it is reasonable and not arbitrary to bar benefits in such a situation.
It's not arbitrary because it's not attributable to any way, shape, or form to the employer. That is the focus here. That was what this court and the Board of Review considered to be the 1961 change to effectuate, is that it has to somehow be attributable to the work action of the employer, like Utley was brought up. Utley was because the employer took some action that created the inability for the person or contributed to the inability of the person to report to work.
Anything you'd like? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Hamburg?
No, it's just the Board of Review is required to follow the statute, follow this court's interpretation of the statute and precedent, and that's what it did.
Thank you. Ms. Conda, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be brief. I want to pick up on Mr. Hamner's significant comment that this case is, quote, not much different than DiLorenzo. That's exactly right. We agree about that. But a couple of clarifications about DiLorenzo. Mr. Hamner attempted repeatedly to characterize that as sort of an act of grace by the board in which it changed its position. That's not actually accurate. This court remanded DiLorenzo back to the appellate division and specifically asked the board for determination on whether or not the employee had actually voluntarily left her job. Did she quit or was she just a innocent victim of illness who intended to keep her job? At that point, the board did come to the conclusion that she hadn't quit, that she hadn't voluntarily left. And when the case then reached the Supreme Court, this court said that that view of the statute was correct. It didn't just concede that now there was a change in position that resolved the matter. The court viewed it as a question of statutory interpretation. And so I echo Mr. Shore that there is no need for the court to adopt any new rule. What the court is required to do in this case is to apply the statute. And that requires first principles of statutory construction, which this court returns to time and again. And the word voluntary is in the statute. It has always been in the statute. In 1961, when there was an amendment, the legislature did not give any evidence to this court that it suddenly wanted to replace that fundamental threshold question with just a consideration of whether things were work-related or not. Is that relevant at some point? Yes, but what this court is asked to do in this case is to simply reaffirm DiLorenzo, reaffirm decades of decisions of this court saying that voluntariness is part of the calculus. It doesn't drop out of the analysis and only look at whether or not something was work-related or not. And of course, in this instance, Mr. Haley did not take any action, any volitional act that jeopardized his employment, and he never quit. He was terminated. And for those reasons, he's entitled to benefits. Just one closing point on that is the court also does not need to decide every circumstance that might arise that calls into question whether or not there was a voluntary departure and whether or not it was work-related. Some of those instances, like in the criminal justice context that Justice Patterson returned to, may not be ripe for a claim under the Unemployment Compensation Act. The court doesn't have to reach that, but the statute requires this court to follow its decision in DiLorenzo and to emphasize that voluntariness is part of the legislative scheme. Unless there are any other questions, I'll leave it
up. I have a question, Ms. Gordon. You're emphasizing voluntariness, but are you asking us to adopt an analysis that requires, as a first step, to determine whether or not a person's not showing up for work is voluntary, and then doing the analysis of the remaining words of the clause?
Yes, Justice LaVecchia.
Do you agree that that changes or has the capacity to change the meaning of all of the words read together?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does, because that is the question of disqualification. The statute is both, it's an interesting statutory language because it is both a disqualification and a safe harbor from disqualification at the same time. So the court has to ask the threshold question of whether or not somebody voluntarily left. And it is only then that the legislature decided to carve out from people who would be disqualified those who left for good work-related reasons. So I don't think it casts the statute in doubt. I think that's consistent with how the court, going back to 1953, has said there has to be, and as Mr. Shore echoed, there has to be a volitional act on part of the employee that suggests they were giving up employment. That may look different in different cases, and the court will take those questions up as they come to the court. But Fennell was a detour in which it said that suddenly voluntariness has no role in the statute. That can't be right. This court looks to the plain terms of a statute and disfavors statutory constructions that render terms chosen by the legislature to be inoperative.
My question, though, is focusing not on ignoring it, but focusing your response on whether or not we must regard it as a singular part of the analysis separate from the remaining words in the clause. And if we do, do you acknowledge that that is a change in the way in which the court has approached these questions in the past?
I'm taking the last part first. I don't think it's a change because that's exactly what this court did in DiLorenzo. Those circumstances being ill were not related to work. The reason why the court found that Ms. DiLorenzo was eligible for benefits was because it looked at whether or not she had voluntarily quit. So I don't think it's a change. I think it's a reaffirmation of how this court has long interpreted the statute. And again, self complicates the question. I acknowledge that.
I acknowledged before that DiLorenzo was sort of in a different category than all of the other cases that we've been talking about.
No, I disagree that it is in a different category. I think the agency attempts to cabinet and say that it was a judge-made exception to the statute. I disagree with that. That DiLorenzo, as this court stated, represented the correct view of the statute. Those are the terms that this court used. And so, no, it's not an exception. It wasn't created by statutory exception. It's a reaffirmation of voluntariness. I know, Justice Leck, you had another question there that I may not have returned to.
We've been going around, I think, on the same question in different formats. You know, for me, the question is whether or not focusing on voluntariness is changing the meaning of the words as a whole. And that's a question that I'll have to wrestle with.
And I guess just on that last, just to say one more thing about it, Justice LaVecchia, is I would expect that if the legislature had intended to wholesale replace the term voluntary with to mean something that is atextual and inconsistent with common sense, that suddenly voluntariness means work-related, it would have said so and given some instruction to this court about how to further its legislative intent. It did not. And in fact, this court has already construed the significance of the 1961 amendments in Brady and in Self. And it said that the purpose of the legislature was not that kind of wholesale rewriting of what is disqualifying. Its limited purpose was to narrow the category of individuals who, though disqualified by a quit, might still avail themselves of benefits. That's the limited purpose. There's no other evidence that the legislature wanted this court to move away from its standard approach of giving plain language its natural meaning. The legislature said nothing of the sort. What happened was, particularly in Fennell, the agency started to collapse the two terms. And that's what this court has an opportunity to correct.
Thank you.
I have one last question, counsel. I'm looking at DiLorenzo. Does DiLorenzo have another limiting principle that would apply here? So I'm looking at the board now holds that when an employee becomes ill and does those things reasonably calculated to protect the employment, okay? And does those things reasonably calculated? Now we know in this particular case, Haley's mother was calling up the employer to try to keep him employed. Is that another connector here?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you can think of that as a way to understand whether it was voluntary. If somebody is trying to hang on to their job, having their mother call every day of the week while they're in pretrial incarceration, they haven't given up their employment. And Justice Alvin, it's an important point because other jurisdictions also look to that kind of requirement in trying to decide whether or not pretrial incarceration followed by no assignment of culpability is voluntary or not. That is a relevant consideration. Did the person just throw up their hands and say, I was done with that job anyway? Or did they say, I want that job, I need that job, and I'm innocent, so I'm going to return one day to the community and be able to access that job? I think it's an important term, and it's a way of understanding whether it was voluntary.
Thank you, Ms. Condon. Thank you to all counsel for